Do you want to learn interesting psychological information in an easy, straightforward, and entertaining manner? Then you need to listen to The Shrink Is In, a podcast show produced and hosted by Dr. Howard Gurr. Dr. Gurr is a practicing licensed psychologist for more than 25 years in New York State, and now he is available to you on the internet. Now, here's Dr. Howard Gurr.
Hey, it's Dr. Gurr with another psychological podcast, and today I'm going to be doing a show on the benefits of exercise on mental health. Now, if you've been a long-time listener to the show, you might say, hey, Dr. Gurr, you did that show already. And the answer would be, yes, I did. But that was of me talking about my own clinical experience. Today, I have an expert in the field who has more information to provide my listeners, and I thought this would be a great topic to revisit with an expert. And so today, I'm going to be talking to Dr. Jack Raglan, who is a professor and director of graduate studies at the Department of Kinesiology at Indiana University in Bloomington. We're going to be talking about exercise and mental health and adherence to exercise programs. Let me give you a little bit more about Jack before we meet him. Jack is a fellow of the American Psychological Association, the American College of Sports Medicine, and the American Academy of Kinesiology and Physical Education. His research involves integrating the use of psychological and physiological variables to examine various issues in sport and exercise, including overtraining, pre-competition anxiety, performance, exercise behavior and adherence, and the relationship between exercise and mental health. So now, let's meet Jack Raglan.
Jack, welcome to The Shrink Is In.
Thanks, Howie. Glad to be here.
Now, Jack, in the intro, I talked about the whole idea of this particular podcast, and let me just go over it again.
Sure.
And that is that as a clinician, you know, doing counseling with depressed patients and patients who have, you know, emotional issues that are interfering with their lives, one of the things that I've always tried to recommend to them is becoming, you know, involved in some kind of exercise program, being physically fit. And I try to explain to them that, you know, you can't separate the mind from the body and the body from the mind. And if one of them is not doing well, the other one is going to go out. You know, getting your body in good shape is not necessarily going to cure your depression, but it's got to help.
Very well may. There's very strong evidence that exercise works equally well as medication in the case of individuals with diagnosed with moderate depression. So it really is a strong medicine both for the body and mind.
Mm-hmm. How would you explain the primary benefits there of physical activity?
Well, the emotional and psychological benefits are wide-ranging. For, let's say, healthy individuals who don't suffer from depression or anxiety, a single dose of exercise, as brief as 15 minutes, can provide a calming effect and increase energy for several hours after the exercise is over. So you get this immediate benefit following each dose of exercise. For individuals who do suffer from anxiety or depression more intensely, you know, clinically diagnosed, let's say, exercise of a very modest regimen can provide, again, benefits that really do match well to medication. And most people can, well, at least a fair number, can stick successfully to these programs. In other words, some people say, well, I'd rather take a pill because it's easier. Well, you know, as you well know, people stop pill regimens.
Mm-hmm.
So the pill is not necessarily that much easier of an alternative. It's challenging, though, in every case.
Mm-hmm. Is there a type of exercise regimen that works more or less better for mental health disorders?
It turns out that for healthy individuals, aerobic exercise seems to have a stronger anti-anxiety effect. For individuals diagnosed with depression, it doesn't seem to make that much difference. It could either be strength training, which certainly provides benefits that people need and will gain from as they get older, but also aerobic exercise. The other important thing is that the dosage in terms of intensity can be rather modest. In other words, it used to be thought, well, you have to work hard and improve your cardiovascular fitness if you're going to get anything out of it psychologically.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's strong contrary evidence that says even a modest regimen can provide a full benefit, or at least is as good as more vigorous activity. So from that standpoint, it's an easier pill to swallow.
So for example, let's say somebody walks 30 minutes a day.
Yes.
There's benefit to that?
Yes, there is, both psychologically and physically. So vigorous walking or vigorous activity like yard work or some sort of recreational activity similar to that will provide psychological benefits.
In the popular press, there's always been that talk of exercise releasing endorphins, and that's what makes people feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any validity to that?
There's actually a lot of contrary evidence. For instance, what I've just described in terms of modest and light activities providing psychological benefits, easy exercise does not stimulate endorphin production. Yet in our research and in studies of others, we found that these light exercise dosages reduce anxiety and produce feeling better sensations that are equal to more intense exercise that does stimulate an endorphin and other hormones. So there's this dosage issue. Secondly, the types of psychological benefits that you see from exercise don't really match those that you would expect to find with an opiate-derived high, so to speak. In other words, mm-hmm. exercise, you feel calmer, more relaxed, but energetic and alert. Using opiates mm-hmm. results in very different sorts of psychological outcomes. So there's that standpoint, too. And then there's also research where they've given people so-called opiate blockers, drugs that block the effects of endorphin during and following exercise, but in most cases they still feel better. So you can eliminate the endorphin contribution, yet people still benefit psychologically. And I know some people are kind of disappointed to hear this, but for me the news is good because it means that, again, it's a light exercise dosage that's easily managed and well tolerated that provides these benefits, not the sort of grueling, extended and difficult exercise that does stimulate endorphin production. The fact is we don't really know why exercise makes people feel better. There's a whole host of physiological and hormonal changes that take place following exercise. There are behavioral changes. There are feelings of mastery and accomplishment, which are significant. And so probably the best guess is that there are several things going on, and you have kind of redundant and reinforcing mechanisms occurring, which means it's a very robust effect.
Unlike the concept that, you know, chicken soup may not necessarily help, but it couldn't hurt. Is there any issue with exercising actually causing negative effects?
There is, although fortunately these consequences are very rare. I think they can be classified to two types. There's the so-called case of exercise addiction, mm-hmm. where people seem to have an unhealthy attachment to physical exercise. These are usually recreational exercisers who continue to exercise more and more and more, usually not to gain further health benefits or to accelerate weight loss or to train for some sort of event. It's just exercise or activity for the sake of activity. And if you ask them why they're doing this, typically they say, well, I don't know, but I can't stop.
Mm-hmm.
These individuals will also exercise to the point where they injure themselves, and instead of doing the right thing, they'll continue, which will exacerbate the injury and sometimes eventually harms them to the point where they are physically unable to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see a classic withdrawal symptoms when they're forced or absolutely have to stop exercising. And it's very different from, you know, feeling bad or a little bit mad at yourself when you miss a session. These are people who suffer severe consequences, sleeplessness, soreness, depression, just from missing a couple of days. The reason why people become addicted, just like the reason why exercise makes people feel better, is unknown. And it's probably due to a lot of factors. But what I very much doubt is that it's some sort of addiction to endorphin or other hormonal consequences of exercise, although there may be some biological basis to it.
Mm-hmm.
The good thing is it's exceedingly rare. It's probably something that occurs in less than 2% of the population, although we don't have good data on that.
Mm-hmm.
The other negative consequence of exercise is limited to athletes who are training intensively. These are serious athletes, not your typical recreational exerciser, people who may train upwards of 2 to 4 hours a day. And what's been found is that as these athletes, for instance, swimmers, increase their training load, there is an elevation in mood disturbance. So instead of exercise making them feel better, it makes them feel worse. And you can map these changes right along with each other. In other words, with each increase in training load, there's a corresponding elevation in mood disturbance. And when you reduce training, for most of these athletes, their mood will improve. Now, in their case, this is an unfortunate but sort of necessary aspect of training. They simply have to undergo these training loads that have these untoward psychological consequences. The good thing is that, again, when you reduce the training, they respond positively, and they look healthy psychologically at the end of the training season, and they can perform better. Mm-hmm. In rare cases, maybe 10% of cases, these athletes go on to develop the so-called staleness or overtraining syndrome. And in these instances, reducing training does no good. They still show elevations in mood disturbance. Many are clinically depressed, and they simply have to stop training and get treated medically and psychologically. They've kind of gone over the edge.
Just want to remind the audience, this is Dr. Howard Gurr for The Shrink Is In, and I'm talking to Jack Raglan, who's professor and director of graduate studies at the Department of Kinesiology at Indiana University. Maybe 20 years ago, I used to write an article for a chain of fitness centers. And one day I came to the owners of the fitness center with an article, and they looked at it and they said, we can't publish this. Uh-huh. And I said, well, why not? They said, well, it's a problem. And I said, well, I don't understand what the problem is. Now, the article was how not to drop out of a fitness program.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, look, what's the issue with printing this article? I said, I understand what your dynamic is. And the reality is that, you know, fitness centers, in a sense, want to sell more subscriptions than they want a service because that's how they make their money. And I said, look, you know, let's be honest. I don't believe that my article is going to drastically turn around any of your, you know, members from dropping out. You know, but at least it's a nice sign to tell them that you care, mm-hmm. and that you want them to stay. And they thought about it for a while, and they said, okay, you got a point. And they did publish the article. But the interesting point is that, as you well know, dropout rates are very high. Absolutely. When it comes to people who are, you know, starting exercise programs. So people would actually join a gym and pay an annual membership, go 2 or 3 months, and then drop out. And they might do it again. So my question, Jack, is what is the real percentage of people who are in physical activity, and what's the difference between the people who maintain themselves in a fitness program, mm-hmm. and those who drop out?
Well, that's a very complicated question. I mean, first, 20 years ago, the average dropout rate of an exercise program was 50%. Today, with all that has changed in the fitness industry and the growth and development in exercise programming, the dropout rate remains 50%. So mm-hmm. it's unchanged. It seems to be sort of a behavioral truism, so to speak. What has changed, though, is that there's been this tremendous growth in health clubs and the fitness industry in general. And I think because of that, there's a turnaround. I think most programs today, most club owners, have a different perspective since they're competing for the same market that they want to keep people in. So I think the one good thing is that there are club owners such as you described still who simply want to sell memberships and turn over those memberships. But a lot of clubs today are much more motivated to help people make these long-term behavioral changes. Now, that doesn't make it any easier for the person who has been unsuccessful or dropped out or simply can't get themselves to start. And it turns out that the 2 to 3 month period that you mentioned is exactly that. That's where most exercise dropouts occur.
Mm-hmm.
So in the first 6 to 8 weeks, you see the greatest dropout, and then it sort of levels off. which is sort of paradoxical, because most people, their incentive and interest and enthusiasm is highest right when they begin a program, you know, make that change. They feel good about it, yet that's the greatest risk period. It turns out that a lot of things are going into play, and you can never truly reduce or simplify exercise behavior or dropout to a single factor. For instance, if you ask people why they've quit, the number one or the most common explanation is not enough time. We hear that, oh, I'm too busy, I can't schedule, I can't work it in. But there are studies where that they've done with prisoners where they've provided them with supervised exercise programs, free shoes, and so on. And of course, this is an environment where you have all the time in the world. But surprisingly, the dropout rate in these cases is 50%, which to me means you can solve the time problem, but it will not necessarily solve your dropout problem. So one thing to keep in mind is that even if people identify a particular reason for quitting or not being successful, and you had successfully addressed that reason, it may not still solve their problem. Something else may occur. It may be that it's an excuse. It may be that they find that their incentive is not so high, even though they have the time to exercise. So I guess what I'm saying is that this is a complicated problem that is rarely amenable by single solutions or the same solution in every case. Now, having said that, there are certain findings and principles that I think can help people. And the first is, if an individual has tried exercise in the past and failed and is trying again and is considering starting a program yet again, the one thing they have to do is go back and look at their history. What were the factors that led them to drop out? Are they the same sorts of factors? For instance, some people, when they have a life change or a period of stress, they tend to drop what they feel is not being essential and then, you know, focus on what they have to solve. And then in the case of exercise, it's like, well, now I'm ready to go back in my program, but it's been 2 weeks. I've fallen off the wagon, so to speak. You know, I don't feel fit anymore. I'm going to have to get back into shape again. So why bother? So what you have to do in these cases is anticipate that that problem is going to occur again and then have a solution ready to begin with, so you aren't grappling with this problem a couple or 3 weeks after the, you know, after being inactive and starting from ground zero. And one of the ways that people can do this is that if you have a standardized exercise program that you're starting, let's say 3 or 5 times a week of walking or so on, what you need to do is rethink this in terms of a lifestyle instead of regimented exercise. So instead of just those 3 trips to the gym, what you need to do is figure out or build in some activity in your off days that is incidental, it's small, it's easy to do, it's not as much, but you're doing something. And in those cases, sometimes when people do miss a session or two or do miss a week of their regular exercise program, they realize that they are still doing something. So there is some fallback, but they haven't gone back to a completely sedentary behavior. So it's sort of reconceptualizing exercise as a lifestyle, something that is plugged into your day, that is easy to get bits and pieces of, rather than that sometimes difficult, if not impossible, trip to the gym. So that's one strategy. Another approach that's been found is that in many cases, having a positive attitude toward physical activity or knowing that it's good for you, having all the knowledge of how it will benefit you, doesn't impact behavior. And I know fitness instructors that say all we have to do is to get people to like exercise or love it as much as I do, and they'll be successful. Well, those feelings and attitudes are important, but again, they don't guarantee a behavior change. What is more important is the attitudes and perspectives of people in your social circle, so your spouse, your loved ones, your family. And there's pretty compelling research that if those people feel that exercise is important, then your adherence rate can increase by, well, 50 to 80 or 90% in some cases. So there's a study, for instance, with heart patients where if they had a positive attitude towards exercise, well, their dropout rate was about 50%. Didn't make any difference. But if their spouse had a positive attitude, then it went up to 80%. So the issue of creating a social support network or surrounding yourself with people who have the same sorts of goals or better yet, getting into a group exercise program where you're not just responsible to yourself, but you're responsible to others or accountable to others, can really make a big difference. And I think this is one of the tools that almost always works. Now, having said that, there is the flip side of the coin, where if your social support network falls out, or if you have a spouse that's trying to booby trap your exercise program, then you're in big trouble. It makes it much, much harder. So those are a couple of things.
You know, given, I guess, the population that I tend to work with, which are, you know, people who are not necessarily athletes, although I have patients who are former athletes, but at this point, you know, just getting involved in an exercise program really for their emotional well-being.
Yeah.
You know, besides, let's say, starting out, you know, with, let's say, walking three times a week for 30 minutes or some kind of exercise like that. Are there exercises that are easier or harder to stick with?
Well, unfortunately, the types of exercise that you would think would be harder to stick with are. In other words, as you increase the dosage, particularly intensity, then you see this precipitous increase in dropout. Now, I say that even though it's obvious, because one thing to emphasize is a lot of popular programs, or at least publicized programs, are high intensity. And there's this long-standing push in the fitness industry to, you know, pump up these kind of high-end cachet programs that really are difficult to do in terms not only of intensity, but skill levels. A lot of people simply aren't coordinated enough to do these types of things. So there is that working against a lot of people who think, well, walking doesn't count because I see, you know, the magazines and the infomercials are doing these other things that are much harder. Well, in terms of dropout, what you have to look at are activities that appeal to people for unusual reasons. I mean, you know, fitness is one thing, but a lot of people, when they reach middle age, it's not, I want to get in shape, it's, I want to have more energy, or I want to reduce my pain, for instance. These are common complaints as people reach their 40s and 50s and beyond, and those are reasons why people don't exercise, but paradoxically and positively, exercise can reduce pain, not create it, and exercise can increase energy in fatigued people. So exercise, if done right, is not fatiguing. Even weight training, if done moderately, leaves people with increased feelings of energy, not fatigue. And so that's something important to realize and sort of give yourself time to experience, which means a couple weeks in an exercise program before deciding it's not for you. Another thing is purposeful exercise. In other words, not just to get in shape or feel better, but let's say you like gardening or you like golf or you want to get back into cycling or some sort of recreational activity. So using a physical activity program to support that. So there was a study done a number of years ago by a Norwegian psychiatrist named Egil Martinsen. It's a landmark study looking at the use of exercise to reduce anxiety in people who are clinically diagnosed with various anxiety disorders. And he had people do run walking, which he expected to improve their conditions, although at that time the party line was that if you had panic disorder, exercise would make it worse. Then he had people do a very simple stretching range of motion exercises, which he regarded as being a placebo. And because he himself was a runner, he was hoping that that would not work. And what he found was that, in fact, both exercise types were equally effective in reducing anxiety symptoms. And what it means is that, you know, something that you might think is very easy and doesn't even constitute real exercise, such as a back health program or a yoga or a tai chi, can have very strong effects and make people feel better and alleviate their symptoms. And the other thing that Martinsen found is that he was running a psychiatric hospital, is that most of the workers there thought that he was going to make life difficult for them, that the patients wouldn't get better, they would have panic attacks and complain. Well, obviously exactly the opposite happened, but what he also found was that the patients ended up preferring exercise more than any of the other treatment alternatives. So therapy, group sessions, medication. And of course, his explanation was, one, the only form of treatment that they themselves were responsible for. So they felt sort of, that feeling of mastery and kind of being in control of their life that they hadn't experienced. And then secondly, of course, they get, as he called it, the side effect of improved fitness. So there's this added benefit. So in terms of exercise types, it's, I think, important, one, to realize that you don't have to do these standard types of activities and you shouldn't feel obligated to even move up to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're comfortable with a light program and it seems to be working, then that's what you should do. You don't have to graduate to the harder things, which lead to people dropping out. And then secondly, to realize that, you know, exercise can improve other aspects or other quality of life issues that you might think it would make worse. And, of course, fatigue is one of the primary issues in depression. And I should point out that there's pretty good evidence that people with chronic depression are, on average, less fit than age match group. So they are starting at a disadvantage of being inactive, probably, and then also being a little less fit. So it's important to take that into account as you try to move into an exercise program.
Jack, unfortunately, we're out of time.
Okay.
I can't thank you enough for the information and answering questions about how to approach this need for physical fitness with my patients. And I believe that anyone who's listening to this podcast, wherever they may be, couldn't help but benefit from the information you provided.
If I were to make one last point, it's that if a person has tried and failed in the past, the thing to keep in mind is that every time you start again, you can use that knowledge and past experience to improve your chances. It takes the average individual 4 to 6 times to try to quit smoking before they succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And we should give those individuals an equal chance to start exercising as well.
Yeah, and I agree. I believe that, you know, physically speaking, we're designed to move. We're built to move and built to be physically active. And that's part of the whole, you know, experience of life. And we have to keep moving to feel better.
Certainly. I couldn't agree more.
So, Jack, thanks again. And until next time, this is Dr. Gerr for The Shrink Is In.
You have been listening to The Shrink Is In, and your host has been Dr. Howard Gerr. If you want to learn more about Dr. Gerr, go to his website at www.drsturr.com.